Down to Business. Sponsored by Flowgas. On the grid, off the grid. Flowgas is Ireland's only supplier of LPG and natural gas. Wherever you are.
Now I'm here at the Big Grill in Harbert Park, and man am I happy. This is a barbecue festival. I've come here especially to meet Nick Solares. He's a Mr. Meat of the USA. He's a man, the man in New York that people listen to when it comes to beef. Nick, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, a real honor.
Now, okay, this is just heaven for me. I'm talking to a meat guy, a barbecue guy, a food critic, somebody who's noted in New York for his reviews of restaurants. But meat and barbecue tends to be your speciality, is that right?
That's what started me in food writing, and it's what sort of sustained my career. I do write about restaurants, restaurant culture, all of these other things, but meat is what is most important to me in terms of food.
So front and central meat.
Front,
okay.
Center, and maybe back and sides too.
Now, you're a food writer, you're a photographer, you're an on-air personality. I know you've done a lot of work with, your blog is The Beef Aficionado?
That was actually what started me. That was basically how I got into food writing.
Okay.
Was I started something called a food blog 12 years ago when there really
right.
were. And I sort of discovered these little satellites of people writing about food. And it eventually sort of coalesced into this, what is now a career for most of us, right? And it really, I'm sort of very lucky that I was at the point where I could sort of follow my passion, and it was kind of this open playground. So I think getting into food now would be much more difficult.
Yeah.
Because there's already such a defined culture. There is such a expectation of what a food writer does. Back then it was kind of the Wild West in many ways.
Okay.
Now, there was no money in it, right? I actually make my career from doing this now. Although I'll say this much, if the calories were dollars, I'd be as rich as you.
Tell me this, you must have an interesting story. How did you actually wander into this business?
It was really for my love of beef. I used to go to this restaurant, I still go a lot, it's called Smith & Walensky. Classic American steakhouse. Actually, it's really considered an Irish-American steakhouse because all of the bartenders are Irish, most of the management. It's a real New York institution. So I used to go to Smith & Walensky every Sunday, and I'd eat the same thing, which is what it's called.
The prime rib.
Exactly. It's called roast beef in this country, right?
Yeah.
Or in Europe. But it's called prime rib in the States. And it is, even today, all of these hundreds of thousands of rib steaks later, still the best thing that I've ever eaten.
Wow.
It's ironic, it's what started me in the business, and it's still my favorite thing. But after a few years of eating the same thing every Sunday from, you know, years on end, I was like, God, there's got to be other steakhouses in New York. And sure enough, there's hundreds of amazing places to eat and eat. So what I discovered was there was a lot of other great steakhouses, and I went to all of them, Peter Luger's, Keen's, The Palm, The Old Homestead, you know. Back then it was Zagat, which is a book.
Right.
Right. There was no internet searches for steak back then. It was really, you crack open a book, and I went through and I checked all the ones that were rated, and I started writing them, keeping a diary. Eventually that made its way into online. And that my first blog was called Beef Aficionado.
Okay.
And I wrote that for a few months, and then I got hired by Serious Eats, who was one of the first professional food blogs. And actually was what, you know, all the blogs there before them had been sort of the adjunct of a print publication.
Yeah.
Serious Eats was from the ground up a website dedicated to food.
Okay.
So I got in very early in that. That sort of led to this career. I reviewed hamburgers and pizza, and then I became the restaurant reviewer. That ended up leading to me doing a iPad app for 0.0, who do Anthony Bourdain's TV show. They're the producers on it, so I did that. And I just started really writing and doing a lot of television and interviews like this one about beef. That eventually led to my full-time work at Eater, which is Vox's food vertical. And really, it's just, since then, it's just been this sort of whirlwind ride where now I'm doing video, and like that's my main thing, and I was doing The Meat Show, which is my my show about meat. It's completely literal. It's this idiot eating hamburgers, telling you about it. But I think that I was very lucky in that I was at the right place at the right time. It was the wrong person at the right place at the right time, right? So I was on this crest, and it's just sort of, it's just kept me going. And so I think that any time that your passion and your innate abilities kind of come together.
And opportunity.
And that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like you can make your own luck by preparing yourself, but you can't really, that eureka moment, it just happens or it doesn't. I happen to be able to be at the right place at the right time, and I got noticed by the right people. And that's sort of what has kept me going.
I've just had a thought When I die, I want to come back as Nick Solares, reviewing restaurants, eating burgers, masses of haunches of meat.
I would like to be coy and sort of, you know, self-effacing, but I f***ing love my life. What can I tell you? I mean, it's, you know, it's I love what I do. But I think that that's important. I think you need to find something that you love.
Yeah.
Whether it's selling coffee or whether it's doing a radio show, whether it's writing about beef, whether it's making motor vehicles, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think that that's what's great about the modern world is that we are increasingly given opportunities to fulfill our passions.
Now, a couple of things I want to ask you. When you're reviewing a restaurant or a barbecue joint or even a hamburger stand, what's the process? How do you actually go about that, Nick?
Well, fortunately, I don't do that much anymore.
Right.
But when I was doing that, it was, you know, I was doing anonymously. You don't announce yourself. And I think that's a difference between European UK journalism on food versus restaurant reviews in the States. I think restaurant reviews in the States are very much consumer reports. And I think that restaurant writing even in the context of a review in Europe is much more cultural.
Yeah.
And you're trying to put not that that doesn't happen in the States, but it is principally, I think, a consumer report. And so I always sort of lent more towards the cultural aspects of restaurant reviewing. So I guess cost is important, but to me, it's about the experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost that the cost is relative to where you are.
And would you go back to the same establishment a couple of times before sort of signing off? Because I think, again, that shows, you know, it shows depth. It shows that I'm not here on a particular moment. I've taken the time to review what's happening here.
Now, when I was reviewing restaurants, we would 2 or 3 visits.
Yeah.
But now, of course, I mean, the restaurant reviewer at Eat in New York is a good friend of mine, Ryan Sutton. He goes 4 or 5 times sometimes.
Right.
It's important. It's also, I think, important to be anonymous. I could never review restaurants now because everyone knows what I look like.
Yeah.
So the service that I would get would be markedly different from just a punter coming in. That's actually, it's a whole level of, if you walk into many kitchens in New York, they have something called a Facebook or a lookbook, and it's basically all the critics, all the food writers plastered on the wall.
So I
see myself all the time because I'm in kitchens a lot.
Yeah.
I think that restaurant reviewing is a very important part of our business. It's not something that I think I would want to do full time. It's arduous.
It sounds like it's kind of outgrown you as well. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, but if you want to do it the way you like to do it, you can only do that for a particular period.
Right. And I think it's something that you do get what we call tablecloth fatigue.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same service over and over. I mean, it becomes to blur together, right?
Okay.
You see the same food on a plate. You see octopus at every restaurant you go to for a season, or then it's uni, and it's, you know, it can be oppressive. It sounds like the greatest thing on earth, but like anything else, it does become work at some point.
Is it true that in LA you really did eat 5 or 6 burgers in one day, or have
I have, yeah, but I'm not eating the whole thing, right?
Right.
I probably ate like 4 or 5 hamburgers divided amongst 17 hamburgers, right?
Because you're looking remarkably trim for a guy who's on the food cycle all the time.
My mum, bless her, we were at the pool a couple of summers ago in Italy, as good sort of middle-class English people do every summer. They sort of toddle off down to Tuscany. And she looks at me and goes, "You look like a fat American." And I was like, "Excuse me, you don't know how fat Americans get." I mean, admittedly, I was a bit heavy. So she put me on the IF diet, intermittent fasting.
Right.
And I tell you, I it's the only diet I've ever stuck to. I've lost about 50 pounds, which is something in stone.
So that's 2 days on 600 calories or less,
yeah,
something of that order.
Exactly, yeah. Which you'd think would be like, for a food writer, would be maddening. But actually, it's not, because I know that the next meal I eat, even if it's in 6 hours or in 36 hours, it's going to be ethereal.
Yeah.
It's going to be prime steak or Wagyu or something. So that's actually what keeps me going through it. But I have found that it makes you appreciate food on a level that you don't have when you just have overabundance of food.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's done great for my diet.
That's good.
I've lost weight.
So and then you really are looking forward to the
after
600 calories. Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of other things. Let's talk meat for a second. Let's talk for longer. But let's talk about it in terms of temperature. So you were probably a dyed-in-the-wood rare man. Maybe as we get older, sometimes we like the temperature to go towards medium a bit more, or is a medium well totally overdone for you?
A medium well, I mean, depending if we're talking about steak, I honestly have trouble eating steak that isn't black and blue these days.
Right.
Though, just to let the audience know, what a black and blue steak is called bleu in French, or Pittsburgh style, and it's basically a cool center and the outside is completely charred. Black. So yeah. Black on the outside, blue on the inside. It doesn't work great for every cut. A ribeye, which is actually my favorite cut, has a lot of intramuscular fat, but also a lot of intramuscular fat. So that's intramuscular fat. It's the muscle, the fat in the muscle, which is good, and then the fat that surrounds the muscle. To render that down, especially with US corn-fed beef, the melting point is fairly high, so you need to cook that to medium rare to really get that. I don't mind eating cold fat, to be honest with you, and especially if it's dry, it's got a lot of flavor. But to answer your question, I like my steak as rare as they'll serve it to me.
Right.
I really don't like medium rare meat. It just doesn't do it for me. But I understand food scientists, chefs, they're correct. That is the optimum temperature to emulsify and to render all that fat.
Yeah.
That said, the steaks we're eating are so marbled. USDA Prime, Wagyu steak, like, it's going to emulsify anyway. I mean, you know.
Now, you are in Ireland. You're here for the Big Grill Festival. You're doing a series of lectures and all sorts of things
right.
for the weekend, which is great, and it's great to have you here. What about the Irish beef scene? And again, it's maybe not for me to say, but I would be very proud in terms of what it is that we have to offer internationally in terms of our beef. It's grass-fed. It's out in open fields, and I think our meat is as good as anybody's.
I said it before, I'll say it again. Irish beef, the best Irish beef is as good as beef gets in the world. And there is, all the things you alluded to, the terroir of this place, and that's obviously a wine term, but, you know, when you eat grass-fed animals that breathe the air around that you're in, that's terroir. You're tasting that animal, you're tasting the land. And I think the Irish beef that I've had, which has only been good quality, because that's really what I'm seeing, it's utterly superb.
Yeah.
You can taste the Verdant nature of this land in the beef. You can taste it in the lamb. There's a vibrancy there, right? That you can taste the sunshine almost. It's captivating.
So as somebody who's lived and worked then in New York for so many years, what do you make of us folk?
Highly civilized, probably the best looking people on earth. Like, you can always spot somebody who's not from Ireland because they're not good looking, right?
Yeah, we'll go along with that.
No, honestly, and I travel all the world eating, and the hospitality here is like second to none. It's the openness, the warmth that people have. It just more than anything, I think the world should learn about Irish hospitality. Then Irish beef and Irish whiskey.
Okay, well listen, it's been a true pleasure to talk to you here today. And thanks very much for being so frank, so honest, and being a bit of fun as well.
Thank you so much.
Nick Solaris, folks, he's at the Big Grill all this weekend. Go and see him. He's well worth checking out.
Down to Business, sponsored by Flowgas. On the grid, off the grid. Flowgas is Ireland's only supplier of LPG and natural gas, wherever you are.